Wisconsin continues to lead the nation in family farm bankruptcies. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are new year-over-year federal numbers that are broken down by the American Farm Bureau Federation. From July 2018 through June of this year, Wisconsin farmers filed 45 bankruptcies under Chapter 12. That's a section of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code that provides financially troubled family farmers with a path to repay all or part of their debts to avoid foreclosure. As a farmer, have you filed for bankruptcy? What was the process like? Did you emerge from bankruptcy? We're at 800-642-1234. Darren Von Ruden is president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Darren, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on this morning, Kate.
Darren, what are you hearing? Why are farmers filing for bankruptcy?
Well, it's all, or the majority of it is the current economic situation that farmers are facing. We're in the fifth year now of low prices for commodities. Dairy, being the dairy state, we certainly have seen that as the majority of the problem. But also in corn, soybeans, beef, swine, chickens, we're all at, you know, all-time lows for pay prices and for an extended period. You know, a lot of years farmers will see 2 or 3 years of lower prices, but then have a year to 18 months of good prices. So the cycle allows farmers to catch up a little bit. But with the extended period that we're seeing right now, it's just having a dramatic effect on farmers' incomes and what they can and can't do.
Yeah, we're going to explore the markets in just a bit, but when a farmer files for Chapter 12 bankruptcy, what does that mean and what happens?
Well, that means that they will start a process that allows them to continue their business, but if they can't get enough creditors to look at them, eventually they could go into total bankruptcy, which means that the bank takes all their property from them, or their lenders will take the property. The majority of the time, they are able to work things out, but there are certain situations, and when it gets bad enough, then the creditors take the either the land and machinery or the animals and sell them to pay off the debt that that farmer owns.
How much debt are we talking about? How much is the debt load of a farmer who is looking at Chapter 12 bankruptcy?
Oh, you could be looking at a smaller operation that might have $500,000, all the way up to larger operations that could have $20-30 million worth of debt.
And how behind on payments would a farmer be?
Most of the time, you have to be 6 months out or so. A lot of creditors, will be somewhat comfortable with a 35-to-60-day mortgage. But once you hit that 6 months that you haven't been paying bills, that's when the creditors really start to get nervous about continuing to provide credit to that operation.
We're talking about family farm bankruptcies and new data showing Wisconsin is still number one in the nation. Darren Von Ruden is president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. You can join in. Are you a farmer feeling the effects of the trade war? Have you dealt with overproduction, low commodity prices, as we've been talking about? Are you contemplating bankruptcy? Join in with your story, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Darren, have you seen farmers stay in business after filing for bankruptcy? Is there a process where they do emerge that bankruptcy can help?
Yes, I have. And it boils down to, sometimes just pure luck. Maybe the pay prices will turn around at the right time and give that farmer, and all the other farmers really a better chance at staying alive. Sometimes it's just the reorganization process that happens under Chapter 12. They're able to put some of their debts into another category and pay a lot lower premium to the creditor, and therefore allowing them, more years to pay off that debt. But then with the turnaround in the economy of agriculture, they are able to do that. This particular cycle, we're not seeing that, though, being we're in that fifth year of low pay prices, and it's looking like we're going to continue down that road for at least the next year, if not the next 2 to 3 years. It's really hard for creditors to look at some operations that are just too far behind already and let them continue operating at losses.
How often do you see farmers looking for other options to make money flow into the farm? Do you see value-added agriculture going on? Do you see them picking up side jobs?
Yeah, you know, that happens kind of on a yearly basis. You know, when pay prices are low for the first year and a half or so, that's when farmers start to look at other opportunities. And we've seen some of that, you know, in the dairy industry here in the state of Wisconsin, where farmers have implemented or put creamery or milk processing facilities on the farm so they can make their own farmstead cheese or sell, you know, different products that are made out of milk that have, you know, the majority of the time have been very profitable. But you got to have a good clientele or a good consumer base close by, too, so it doesn't work for every single dairy operation, but it has worked for some in the past.
And there's risk as well, because you have to buy a, you know, different set of technology, and you have to open up a different type of business.
Right, right. And that's, you know, that's not cheap neither at all. It's, by the time you buy all the stainless steel and the processes that are needed to make the cheese, that adds that expense, and plus you have to most of the time do quite a bit of advertising to get the consumer base that you need to keep that facilities up and operating.
What are some other ways that you're seeing farms get by, make ends meet?
Well, certainly going to town and getting another job, or maybe sometimes two jobs. You know, the husband and wife and maybe the kids have to work off the farm to help bring in some income to keep that farm running. And I know one thing that, you know, some farmers are really starting to talk about is how this expensive hobby that we have is just getting to be too much, and there really isn't a job in town or in the neighborhood that can help you keep that farm alive.
When you say expensive hobby, I mean, are you saying that lightly? Because farming is an industry. It goes well beyond a passion. It is certainly a career and a livelihood.
Right, right. You know, so it's one of those things that, you know, it's in most cases, it's that trying to lighten the mood so that we can really think about, you know, in a different aspect versus the real stress that, you know, farm economy is putting on most farmers nowadays.
Wisconsin has led the nation in farm bankruptcies in recent years. We're talking about the plight of the family farm with Wisconsin Farmers Union President Darren Von Ruden. Have you recently had to sell off your herd or perhaps sell your farm? How long did your family operate the farm? Why did you sell the business? Are you going through Chapter 12 bankruptcy right now? What is the process like? Join in the discussion with your questions, your story, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back to this discussion in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about farm bankruptcies as Wisconsin continues to lead the nation in the number of filings. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Farm bankruptcy filings in the year through June were up 13% from 2018, and loan delinquency rates are on the rise. Wisconsin, Kansas, and Minnesota led the nation in Chapter 12 filings. Minnesota increased so significantly in the past year that they reached the highest levels of the past decade. Farmers, have you contemplated filing for bankruptcy? What do you think about the financial position of family farms in Wisconsin? We're at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Darren Von Ruden. He's president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Let's go to the phones now with Owen joining us from Wyawega. Hi, Owen.
Good morning. Good morning, Darren.
Good morning.
So, I have a neighbor that's just filed Chapter 12, and he, just 2 years ago, he built a 700-cal dairy facility. I think they were milking 300 or so, and they decided to add on another 400 cattle. And so this was a strategic move because they were going through a divorce, and in order to eliminate having to pay his wife any type of, alimony or whatnot, he just went into a bankruptcy to show that he has no assets and he's in debt. And what really the kicker on this was is his daughter was able to borrow from the beginning farmer loan program at our local FSA office here in Waupaca County. And I tried to borrow it from the same office, from the same loan officer, and I was told no, but she was told yes. And now they're in Chapter 12 and they've defaulted on all their loans. So to me, this is just a strategic move for some of these bigger farms to use in order to erase their debt, become more profitable in the long run, and, you know, in the short term, they showed, you know, their assets.
Oh, and I want to jump in here and let Darren respond to how the FFA is helping or assisting farmers. And I know that, Darren, you can't speak to that specific case that Owen is talking about, but what is the FFA doing?
But they're certainly allowing, you know, for certain operations to come and get financing through them. The majority of the time, they are the lender of last resort and certainly have a little bit more of a relaxed borrowing atmosphere. But, you know, they do have certain programs, and one of them that Orrin mentioned, too, that allows for females or ladies to borrow versus gentlemen that might be looking at, and that's part of trying to diversify the people who actually own farms or land and animals throughout the country. It's not a Wisconsin specific thing. It's something that the FSA does throughout the country.
Well, Darren, before we get to the end of the conversation, it's really important that we get to tariffs and what is going on in this trade war with China. The American Farm Bureau Federation, it said exports of farm products to China fell by $1.3 billion in the first half of the year. How is this current trade war affecting Wisconsin farms?
Well, it certainly is duplicating the economic stress that farmers are seeing throughout the state. When you're losing markets that it took a couple decades to build up, and knowing that those markets probably are not going to come back the day after an agreement is signed, which right now that doesn't look like that's anytime soon, neither at all. There's just too much difference between the U.S. and the Chinese and who wants what. So, you know, it's really starting to look like as farmers we're going to have to either find new markets or figure a way out to bring supply and demand more in balance.
Governor Evers sent a letter to President Trump recently asking him to stop the tariffs. What else can be done at the state level to help farmers during this trade war?
You know, being, especially on the dairy side of the business, being it's more of a national issue, meaning that we're really in a world market right now, that's really kind of a federal thing. There are some states that do have state programs, but those states are also some of the smaller dairy-producing states that have, a program that pays farmers maybe up to a couple dollars, a hundredweight and more for their milk that stays in the state, but also they, you know, want to encourage farmers to stay in business, and that's why programs like that are going on. You know, here in the state of Wisconsin, as the second largest producer in the country, we would bankrupt the state treasury in a matter of days, basically, if we were going to do a program similar to that one. And the one I'm talking about is the Maine Dairy Program.
Well, Darren, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Kate.
Darren Van Ruden is president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Former Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Glenn Mulberg passed away this past weekend. Glenn was known as a tough but fair interviewer. He was also loved playing music and using sound to tell stories. His skill as a journalist and talk show host could clearly be seen and heard in the hundreds of stories and segments he produced for WPR. News director Noah Ovchinsky has this remembrance.
Glenn Mulberg had a long resume. He was a talk show host, a musician, active in a community that he loved, a husband, a father, and he was a reporter's reporter.
Glenn, he would come to some events, and he'd have his headphones on, and he'd have his equipment strapped to his belt, and you could see him coming, you know.
Republican State Senator Jerry Petruski has represented the Wausau area for years and was frequently interviewed by Glenn. He says Glenn wasn't afraid to ask the hard questions, but
I think he did his job, and he did it with a real professional, genuine caring about what he was doing and what his job included.
They didn't always see eye to eye, but Petruski says one of the things that really stuck out about Glenn was his genuine love of central Wisconsin. He says he was truly committed to the people in the region. Glenn asked hard questions. He did not do softballs, both in the field and on his talk show Route 51. As former Democratic state lawmaker Julie Lassa knew well, she represented the Stevens Point region for nearly two decades.
So you had better have done your homework, because he had, and he was going to ask you some really good, thoughtful questions in order to make sure that his listeners were informed on the issue.
Lassa says Glenn would not move on until he got a real answer.
He was always the type of reporter and interviewer to bring you back, to try to make sure that you weren't able to skirt around an issue. I always respected that about him.
With Glenn, though, it wasn't just about the questions. He had high expectations when it came to his work and his guests. According to WPR regional manager Rick Ryer, Glenn's rules were clear.
We would have the opposing candidates in the studio together, and Glenn would sit them down before the microphone went on. He said, "This is how it's going to go. We don't yell in the studio. We have a civil conversation about things we differ on."
Of course, Glenn also had a softer side. Over the years, he covered some of the most tragic events to hit his region. Some made headlines, like shooting sprees and a helicopter crash. Others were smaller stories about pervasive problems like homelessness. In each story, he approached his subjects with empathy and a desire to give a voice to the voiceless. You can hear it in stories like this.
This is the kind of cold that burns your nostrils and hurts your eyes. It's the kind of cold that shuts down schools and even retail businesses. And for the homeless here on the streets of Wausau, it can be deadly.
By the time I walked two blocks, I had ice in my mustache, eyelashes.
Glenn loved sound. He often spoke about the importance of entertaining listeners while also delivering the news. One of his favorite stories, and mine, was about bears. Glenn went into the field with some researchers and took the audience with him.
The party pushes through the spindly growth to the den where the groggy mother lays with her four cubs. Codavis plunges the syringe into her side, and soon she's asleep. The tiny cubs are pulled away and handed one at a time to the volunteers. They look like cuddly teddy bears. They sound like banshees.
Glenn would spend hours working to get the sound just right on stories like that. He also spent his life immersed in other kinds of sound, usually involving a guitar. Glenn was an accomplished singer-songwriter who often played on his show Route 51 and in gigs around the community. Wausau was a frequent muse.
W-A-U-S-A, and the only thing missing is you.
One of Glenn's favorite guests was jazz violinist and composer Randy Sabine. Here they are playing Soul of a Man on Route 51.
Soul of a Man, tell me, Glenn.
What is the soul of a man? For Glenn Mulberg, it was a life filled with family, countless friends, music, and bringing the voices of his community alive through his reporting.
What is the soul of a man? What is the soul of a man? What is the soul? What is the soul? What is the soul of a man?
And that was WPR News Director Noah Ovshinsky remembering reporter Glenn Moberg, who passed away this past weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking health in our 60s on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The good news is education levels are rising, average life expectancy has increased, and poverty among older Americans has dropped sharply over the past half century. This comes from the Population Reference Bureau's latest aging report. If you're in your 60s, what changes in your health did you notice when you entered this decade? What surprised you? What do you wish you knew before turning 60? Ask away at 800-642-1234. Dr. Terry Nordine is a family medicine physician at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. Dr. Nordine, let's look at bone health. The CDC is reporting that osteoporosis affects about a quarter of women age 65 and over, about 5% of men in that same age group. What is osteoporosis?
So osteoporosis is a thinning of your bones where the deposition of calcium is not as dense as it used to be. So your bones just are not as sturdy as they once were earlier in your life. And it leads to an increased risk of having fractures. And namely, we think most often about hip fractures or fractures in your vertebrae in your spine.
Yeah, and those hip fractures, especially at a later age where you're having to undergo surgery, that can bring on more complications.
It absolutely can, and we kind of start to have an elevated risk for that in our 60s. So the typical recommendation for a postmenopausal woman is to start getting screening tests for that low bone density at age 65. And typically we do that with a bone scan called a DEXA scan.
And what happens in that bone density test? How is it done?
So typically you're given an agent, often through an IV, that helps to make your bones more visible, and they use a low amount of an X-ray in order to see how dense and thick your bones are. And then they're able to use some computer calculations that help tell you what your level of risk of osteoporosis is within your spine and your hips.
We remember being told as a kid to drink milk for bone health, but what is the best way to take care of our bones and prevent osteoporosis?
So I'm all for a balanced diet, and drinking milk and getting calcium can be part of that. But the sad part about this is that most of the calcium that we have in our bones and the buildup of that was done in our 20s, 30s, and 40s. So by the time we're in our 60s, the dietary part of it alone is kind of past what we can take care of to keep our bones healthy. So the best way to keep your bones healthy in your 60s and onward is actually exercise, like we talked about before. That 150 minutes of moderate aerobic exercise is beneficial. And specifically for your bone health, you want to have weight-bearing exercise. So you want to be up and walking, or you want to be bearing weight so that the pull of gravity and your work of your bones actually helps to make your bones stronger.
Would carrying some small weights or doing some repetition work with weights, would that help?
Absolutely. So in addition to that 150 minutes of aerobic exercise, strength training two or more times a week can be beneficial as well for keeping your bones and your muscles strong.
Dr. Nardine, let's look at cancers. As we age, our risk for certain cancers goes up. What kind of cancer should people in their 60s be most concerned about?
That's a great question, Kate. So one of the main things that both men and women should be mindful of and aware of is colon cancer. About one in every 10 individuals in a lifetime will be affected by colon cancer. And the great thing about our screening tests and treatment protocols for this is colon cancer has become essentially a completely preventable disease. If you're getting your colon cancer screening tests done in a timely manner and catching things early while they're still precancerous, cancerous polyps, pretty much all of almost every case of colon cancer can be prevented. So between the ages of 50 and 75 is when we recommend getting colon cancer screening completed. And you can do that with a colonoscopy or with other tests called like fecal immunohistochemical testing or a FIT test. Or there are also stool tests that look for signs of problematic DNA from precancer or cancerous cells in your stool. So there's lots of options in terms of how to get that colon cancer screening done.
We're talking with Dr. Terry Nardine. She is a family medicine physician at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. Let's talk a little more about heart attacks. The National Institute on Aging says people age 65 and older are more likely than younger people to suffer a heart attack or to have a stroke or to develop heart disease, heart failure. Can you explore with us how the heart changes as we age?
Part of it is not just the heart, but the blood vessels that help the blood travel to the different places in our body. So as we age, we get a little bit of a stiffening or hardening of our blood vessels, which are essentially almost like the plumbing or the pipes that the blood flows through in our body. And as those age and get a little bit harder, there's less elasticity or less give in them, and they're more prone to minor injuries. Additionally, we've had years and years of various elements in our diet and due to our genetics of levels of cholesterol within our blood and within our body. And whenever we have excess cholesterol, we tend to deposit that in our blood vessels in certain locations. So it's that time effect over several years, over those 60 plus years, that leads us to having those increased risk factors for heart attacks and for strokes. In addition, whenever your heart has to pump against more stiff blood vessels, it works harder. It has a little bit of a harder job of doing its normal duty of pumping blood through our body. And so it can wear out a little bit. It can get a little bit tired and fatigued. The muscle can get overworked in a way that's not healthy for it and can cause some problems with how the heart fills or how the heart compresses and pushes out the blood. So all of those factors lead to having significant problems with heart disease, stroke, congestive heart failure and other issues.
Yeah, we've heard about taking a statin, to help lower cholesterol. What are statins and are they a good idea?
So statins are a class of medications that can lower your cholesterol level. So they work within the process of your liver metabolizing and creating cholesterol. There are some level of cholesterol that everybody needs. So cholesterol is not a universally bad thing. And our fats in our body are not universally bad. We've got two different categories. We've got a low density lipoprotein, or our LDL, which is typically considered our bad cholesterol. The higher that level is, the higher risks we have for having problems like heart attack, stroke, peripheral vascular disease, and congestive heart failure. We also have a protective type of cholesterol or a protective fat called HDL, or a high-density lipoprotein. The higher that is, tends to be cardioprotective. Statins affect the way our liver makes and metabolizes cholesterol in a way that lowers that LDL and lowers that bad cholesterol. So we've got good data that we can increase our cardiac benefit by being on a statin medication. Now, we know not everybody necessarily needs a statin medication, but if you have an elevated risk for heart attack, then it may be beneficial for you to do. One of the things that you can have done is have your cholesterol checked by your provider, and they can put your numbers, such as your age, your blood pressure, your cholesterol numbers, whether or not you have diabetes, whether or not you are a smoker, into an algorithmic risk calculator called the ASCVD risk score. So that's looking at your atherosclerotic risk of problems with your heart, with your vasculature in terms of cardiovascular disease. And typically, if your risk is 7.5% or higher, your provider would recommend that you start on a statin medication. And typically, especially for men in their 60s, they have higher risk than women in their 60s. But as you age, that is the number one factor that makes your risk higher and higher.
Dr. Nordine, how important are things like sleep?
Sleep is very important. Getting the right amount of sleep for your brain to kind of process everything that happened to you throughout the day before, as well as rest for your body, is really valuable. One of the things that we've learned is when your brain and body do not get enough sleep, it can have detrimental effects on your health. One big example is with the illness or entity of obstructive sleep apnea. We know that having obstructive sleep apnea, which means you have a blockage in your airway at night when you sleep, that is often due to redundant or extra tissue in your throat or in your soft palate, that causes you to snore very loudly and can have you stop breathing and get in the way or obstruct your airway in the middle of the night. That lowers your oxygen levels circulating throughout your body in a way that's detrimental. That can lead to high blood pressure. It can lead to congestive heart failure. It can lead to struggle with losing weight and worsening obesity, as well as several other entities and problems that can affect your health.
And so you can also try to use a CPAP or some type of device over your mouth in order to keep that air circulation?
Yes, so the most common treatment for obstructive sleep apnea that shows the most effectiveness is a CPAP machine, which stands for continuous positive air pressure. So that helps to keep the airway open all night while you are breathing. So that machine does not breathe for you, but it helps to keep that airway open so that you are getting all of the oxygen that you need during your sleep.
We're talking about staying healthy after 60 and steps you can take to improve your health in this decade. Did your health change for the better or for the worse during this decade? What happened? And what did your parents or grandparents experience during their 60s? What do you wish you knew before you entered this stage of life? Call in. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll be back in just a moment for more of this health conversation right here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring all aspects of health in our 60s here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. A century ago, the average life expectancy for people born in the U.S. was about 56 years, and today that's risen to almost 79 years. As baby boomers age, the number of U.S. adults over 65 is expected to more than double by 2060, outnumbering children for the first time. Are you over 60? What is your health goal for this year or for this decade of your life? Still time for you to share at 800-642-1234. Dr. Terry Nordine is a family medicine physician, and she stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Kimberly joining us from Toma. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi. Hello, Dr. Terry. Please remind the people that I used to be a nurse and worked in surgery and orthopedics and everything. And the thing that you got to warn people about is that the carbonation in sodas, and we're all addicted to sodas, flushes calcium out of your bones. That's very important.
Kimberly, thanks for bringing that to the table. Dr. Nordine, what about drinking soda?
So, Kimberly, good morning, and thanks for the greeting. In terms of your overall bone health, I think you gain so much more by doing that weight-bearing exercise than the potential detriments of other things in your life. So I think the number one message I want people to walk away with is exercise, exercise, exercise. And if you are drinking soda, one of the things to take a look at is, are you drinking soda that has a lot of calories? When we look at obesity and people who have difficulties with their weight or people with difficulties with diabetes, one of the things that's fairly easy for them to cut out of their diet that takes out a lot of sugar are those carbonated sugar-filled sodas.
What about drinking any type of carbonation, like carbonated water?
So that's not something that I've seen that I have a lot of information about in terms of bearing out in the research in terms of carbonation being very detrimental to our bone health.
Let's bring in John now in Boaz. John, hi.
Hi. I'm in my 60s. I turned 61. And I chose to quit the computer age and join the hippies and the 60s and 70s back to earth people. I bought a farm on a hill. I built a log cabin. Well, I get plenty of exercise because I have to carry the water from the road up to my house.
Oh, goodness.
And that
is
the best thing for your ankles and your legs and your back.
Wow, John, that is quite the shift, quite the change, Dr. Nordine.
Yeah, John, it sounds like you've made some transitions and some gotten after some particular life goals with this transition into your 60s. I think you're right. Trying new things like starting to farm when you haven't done that before, building a log cabin, those are great skills to help keep you active. And if you build in your exercise routine into your daily activities, then you're more likely to stick with it than if you count it as, quote, exercise. That's something you have to do above and beyond things that you don't enjoy doing. So finding some physical activity that you enjoy really is helpful for keeping you healthy.
Yeah, John, and lift with those legs, not with your back on that water. Dr. Nordine, what about sexual health in our 60s? What happens in this era?
So contrary to popular belief, sexual health can be alive and well for people in their 60s. So I think people younger than 60 tend to think about reaching your sexual peak much earlier than that and having a dwindling of sexual activity. But there are plenty of people in their 60s that keep an active and healthy sexual life and sexual appetite. One of the things that we notice after menopause in women is that vaginal dryness can play a role at making being intimate with your partner a little bit more difficult. But there are ways around that. Two of the most common things that I recommend for my patients who are experiencing vaginal dryness or pain with intercourse is to try a silicone-based lubricant with their sexual activity or try olive oil. So if you use just the same olive oil that's non-flavored and does not have any other additives in it, but just plain olive oil from your kitchen as a lubricant or to combat that vaginal dryness, sometimes that can help recharge your activities with your partner in a way that both of you find mutually beneficial.
Some people in their 60s may be needing to use the restroom more often. Is that normal or should it be a concern?
So that's a great question, and the answer to that is it kind of largely depends on the context. So later in life, both men and women can tend to have more tendency to use the bathroom more frequently in terms of urinating. And if it's very frequent, like once an hour, or you're having discomfort when you urinate, those can be signs of a urinary tract infection. But both for women who have given birth and who have kind of carried their musculature inside their belly around for a long time, it can weaken some of the pelvic floor muscles that you have there that help keep your bladder in place and help keep all of your organs in place when you are upright and coughing and sneezing. So some women can have some symptoms of incontinence or feel as though they need to get to the restroom very quickly. Some of that can come on with age, and talking with your provider about it can be beneficial to help you find strategies to combat that. In terms of men in their 60s, sometimes they use the bathroom a little bit more frequently because they may have an increase in size in their prostate that may make it a little bit more difficult for them to empty their bladder. So if you're having any signs of urinary issues, it would definitely be beneficial for you to talk with your doctor about it.
This is the decade when people are leaving the workforce, entering retirement, and this can also be a jarring life change, you know, losing social connections, perhaps from work, personal fulfillment in jobs. Can you explain for us what these challenges look like and the importance of managing mental health during these years?
So anytime you have a significant change, it can be fairly jarring to your life and to your perspective. So making sure you've got an intact social network where you have people you can talk to about what you're thinking, what you're feeling, and what you're experiencing is key. So especially for someone who is looking at retirement, if your job has been a place for social connection for you, you want to be intentional about building that social connection and that social network so that you have that benefit and that network of folks to rely on when things pop up. So not only is that a transition that can be difficult in our 60s, but because of so many health concerns that come on in their 60s, you could also experience the loss of friends and family members. And depending on whether or not your parents are still around when you're in your 60s, you can be experiencing some difficulties and challenges from that perspective as well, with seeing the end of life in those around you and in some loved ones.
So, Dr. Nordine, is it ever too late in life to get healthy, or can our 60s be a good time to start a new regimen to build some healthy habits?
There is no time in your life that is too late to turn over a new leaf and work on being more healthy. So getting into your physical activity and healthy diet and healthy lifestyle, there's always benefit from that. So you can never start that too early, and it's never too late to start that either.
Well, as we wrap up here, after our 60s, it comes the 70s. Are there any tips you'd like to leave us with for people who will enter that next decade?
Well, I think for anyone in their 60s looking at their 70s, I think the 60s, when you are still of reasonably good health, is the time to think about the topic of advanced directives, things like a living will and designating a healthcare power of attorney. I always find that it's a lot easier for people to make those decisions about their end of life when they are healthy and doing well compared to when they have a significant number of health problems and are under the stress of acute situations. So if you've not yet talked about that with your doctor, please do so. There's a program in Wisconsin called Honoring Choices that's put on by the Wisconsin Medical Society that can help give you some information about creating those advanced directives and creating a living will and designating somebody as your healthcare power of attorney.
Dr. Nordine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Terry Nordine is a family medicine physician at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire, and she joined us from our studios in Eau Claire. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.